It's clearly true that putting resources into small-scale farming will slow down the departure of people from small-scale farming. That's no question. But I think that the benefits of alleviating poverty in the medium term make that a cost worth taking. At the same time, we have to make sure that we don't take steps that lock in an inefficient distribution of land holdings.
Welcome to Development Dialogues, a podcast series bringing together experts from research and policy to answer questions that are key to addressing today's most complex global development challenges. We'll discuss how the latest research in development economics can inform strategies to fight poverty, reduce inequality, and drive inclusive economic growth. Development Dialogues is a collaboration between Yale's Economic Growth Center and VoxDev. Hello, and welcome to Development Dialogues. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. In this episode, we'll ask, what's holding back smallholder farming in Africa? For decades, small farms have been at the center of rural life and rural policy across much of the continent. But despite significant investment and innovation, productivity remains stubbornly low. Yields lag far behind those in high-income countries, even when farmers use similar technologies. So what's going on? Are small farms under-supported or fundamentally unsustainable in today's economy? Should we invest in helping smallholders thrive or begin transitioning toward fewer, larger farms? Or is there a path forward that does both, supporting smallholders while also creating opportunities for scale where it makes sense? To unpack these questions, we're joined by Gerardine Mukeshimana, Vice President of IFAD, or the International Fund for Agricultural Development. Previously, Mukeshimana served as Rwanda's Minister of Agriculture. Christopher Udry is the Robert E. and Emily King Professor at Northwestern University. He's a development economist whose research focuses on rural economic activity in sub-Saharan Africa. Udry was also senior editor of the VoxDev Lit on Agricultural Technology in Africa. And Mark Rosenzweig is the Frank Altschul Professor of International Economics at Yale University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's the author of Are There Too Many Farms in the World? Labor Market Transaction Costs, Machine Capacities, and Optimal Farm Size. They engage in a bold and honest conversation that challenges conventional thinking and explores new possibilities for the future of farming in Africa. Let's dive in. Gerardine, Chris, Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Gerardine, I'll start with you. You led Rwanda's agriculture ministry during a time of real growth and transformation. What were some of the key things that made that possible? And also, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced, especially when it comes to the question we're tackling today? What's holding back smallholder farmers?
I don't think that there is any single magic bullet in this landscape of smallholder agriculture. The way I was approaching it when I was in Rwanda was looking at system-wide, what can be done. Farms in Rwanda are really small, so they are around 0.4 hectares, and they provide 90% of the food that is consumed in the country, and they provide more than 30% of export revenues of the country. There is a lot of innovation that needs to be there to make sure that these farms that are super tiny can be productive. So that means you approach it from end to end, from research to the market. We were really facilitating a lot of research activities to have varieties that are fitting agroecological zones of Rwanda. We were investing in digital technologies to make sure that the seed and fertilizers are getting to the farmers. We were supporting farmers to aggregate their plots so farmers can gain economies of scale in terms of investments, but also in accessing to the market, working on a post-harvest management so that whatever is produced doesn't get lost, but also linking to the market so that the farmers can not be discouraged to reinvest again. You asked for challenges. One of the challenges that I already mentioned is the size of the plot. That's really small. The second is the access to finance. Small-scale farmers, we usually see that they are sometimes the poorest of the communities. So having the capital to invest in that context is not an easy thing. So we were doing a lot of work to try to bring in the private sector to work with the banking community so that they can get some credits into the hands of the farmers, working on de-risking mechanisms so that if something happens, it's not a total loss. In this context, the public money needs to be there to be able to de-risk or to bring in the private money.
So you're right, Geraldine, that there's no silver bullet. But some would say we've been overlooking a big structural issue that cuts across a lot of these challenges, the size of farms. Mark, you've even posed the question, are there too many farms in the world? So can you expand on that?
Sure. Let's be clear about what the scale of the problem is. For all of the interesting growth that's occurred in African countries and other low-income countries, the gap between incomes between those countries and developed countries in the world is still enormous. And the yield differences are enormous as well. And the key difference when you look at agriculture in African countries and low-income countries, China, India, Pakistan, wherever you look, Colombia, is the size of farms. And we're talking about farms that are 1.5 acres on average in many of these countries, as compared to 450 acres in the United States. That's the first order salient difference in agriculture. Now, why is small scale a problem? Why could it be something that is the fundamental reason for this gap that we see? There are three that are technological. The first is that because of the costs of hiring labor, what we find is in these countries that there is, in fact, a lot of slack. There's a lot of underutilized land in these countries. Labor is slack. If we look at the average hours per day that a worker works, that's reported in good data sets that are nationally representative, more than half of them are working 6 hours or less per day. The second thing, because of the cost of hiring labor, there's essentially an absent labor market in most of the countries, which means not only is there slack in labor, that it's not profitable to hire the labor that's needed to farm the additional half an acre that they'd have. Then what we see in addition to the slack is that the differences in the productivity of labor across farms is different. So there's a misallocation of labor. Where labor is more productive, one should be hiring more labor, but that's not happening. And the third thing is the obvious technological features of modern agriculture in high-income countries, which is mechanization, right? That's the key feature. And mechanization cannot be exploited on tiny farms. You can't move a tractor onto a 1.5 acre farm. It's that simple. The economies of scale from mechanization are enormous. So they're unexploited. So we have slack resources and unexploited scale economies from small farms. And when we did simulations that are reported in the paper for India, where we took farms that were on average about 2 acres and made them all 25 acres, we got an increase in output of 42% and an increase in income per worker of 68%. And most of the increase in yields was not from the magic of scale economies, but was essentially just reducing all of the slack that was in the economy. That once they were of sufficient scale, they could save on labor, so they didn't have to hire as much labor, but they were of also sufficient scale that these fixed costs of hiring labor became a trivial part of expenses and profitability. So these are big jumps in productivity, not the small jumps that we see from fixing a lot of the other kinds of problems that are very real in agriculture, from lack of appropriate technology, et cetera.
Small-scale farming is not a problem per se, but the problem is how they get supported to aggregate their lands. I can give an example for my previous life. We aggregated 12 hectares of land. We supported the mechanization and the irrigation. It wasn't really surprising to see that despite that every single farmer was probably having less than a hectare of land, but the productivity increased significantly. And that wouldn't be sufficient if we were not linking these farmers to the market so that they can be back and be able to invest. So the reason I'm saying this is just to bring in into the conversation, that lens of policies, small is not a problem. The problem is how the policies are accompanying them to be able to produce.
I think Mark has put together very convincing evidence that there's potentially huge gains from making operational farm holdings larger. The most obvious being the gains from potential mechanization and the reductions in the importance of the transactions costs in labor and land markets relative to overall scale of production. if there's such great returns, the question now is, why haven't actors individually in the market found ways to aggregate their land holdings and take advantage of these economies? And at least in the parts of Africa which I'm most familiar, which is mostly West Africa, one of the crucial barriers to undertaking such consolidation is the land tenure system. It's not the case that individuals have the free rights to rent out land to each other, to sell land to each other, because people have rights to land by virtue of membership in larger communities, in extended families and in communities. And as a consequence, individuals trying to accumulate land to make larger landholdings to take advantage of these economies that Mark describes aren't able to do so. There may be very good reasons for the structure of land tenure in these societies. And so it's worth thinking about that when we talk about the potential advantages of having larger scale farm holdings.
In India, there are no such problems. That is to say, the rights of ownership and leasing are pretty well formed. It's all digitized. It's okay. Yet we see also the same thing. The farms are small, yet we're talking about these enormous scale economies that seem pretty obvious that exist. So why don't farms aggrandize? I think the answer is the inverse productivity relationship one sees in the scale of farming that is observed in low-income countries. That is to say, for most of these farmers, a marginal increase in scale will actually reduce profitability, because what it does is increase the scale, which means they would need more labor in order to cultivate that additional acreage. But because of the transaction costs in labor or the absence of the labor market, they can't do it. So in fact, productivity goes down. So there is in fact no return to incremental changes in land sizes at these small scales. What they have to do is go from 2 acres to, in our data in India, again, where land rights are fine, to say over 12 acres. Now, in order to do that, a farmer with 2 acres who's surrounded by other farmers of 2 acres has got to have contractual relationships with 5 or 6 other farmers, all of whom know that there are gains to the farmer that's doing it. So there's a holdup problem. So the barriers are sort of natural. It's a trap to be small size that improving land rights are not going to solve. And in fact, in the history of the world, as far as I know, there has never been an aggrandizement from very small farms to large farms without external intervention on the part of government. The last large-scale one was, in fact, in France at the end of World War II, which forced farmers to sell out and to consolidate landholdings. And again, there was an enormous increase in output, which they expected. And again, they had to deal with the fact that where was all that output going to go? And the common market was, in fact, partly formed in order to create a larger market for the increased output that was going to arrive from the consolidation. We can talk about what the solutions might be to overcoming these natural barriers, which are just not going to happen from bootstrapping the farmers. It's going to have to come from some other means of inducing this to happen, which will be in the farmers' interest, but of course is going to lead to far less people in agriculture, which of course characterizes high-income countries. That's the world which I would think we want to see Africa, India, and other countries belong to, in which there are very few very high productive farmers producing more output of food than ever before, right? But most of the population is urban and not in agriculture.
Mark has made a compelling case for why we should pay more attention to farm size and scale. But of course, that's only part of the story. So, Chris, I want to turn to you. From your own research and the Vox DevLit on agricultural technology in Africa, one key takeaway is that there's no single reason why productivity and technology adoption remain low. So can you walk us through some of those other barriers?
There's clearly a myriad of barriers that make it difficult for small-scale farmers in Africa to increase productivity of their farms and to adopt new technology. Gerardine mentioned some of them: the difficulty in having access to capital, the importance of risk, and the failure of there to be fully functioning insurance markets. Then there's problems of access to labor and poor infrastructure with respect to roads that makes the cost of inputs for farmers very high, and the price of output relatively low. So these are all real problems that make the productivity of farmers in Africa lower than it could otherwise be. And another problem, which I think is very important for most African farmers, is that there is strong evidence of an enormous amount of heterogeneity in the physical and economic environment that farmers are operating in. In the United States, if you compare the ratio of yield, that's output per acre, on, say, maize farms across the Midwest of the United States, and rank farms by their yields, the ratio of the 95th percentile of yields to the 5th percentile of yields, so the extremes of the distribution, is about 190%, so say 200%. So the most productive farmers are three times as productive as the least productive farmers. In Uganda, much smaller, or Tanzania, those same ratios are 10,000% in Uganda, or 3,000% in Tanzania. There's just vastly more variation across farms in productivity in Africa than there is in other parts of the world. A lot of that has to do with the relatively poor infrastructure. And so factor prices are very different. And so optimal decisions on farms are very different. A lot of it has to do with the fact that there's no irrigation. And so there's much more risk involved in agriculture. People rely on rainfall. A lot of it has to do with fundamental characteristics of the land, where in the United States, there's been a lot of anthropogenic changes in the types of characteristics of the farms. There's land leveling, there's irrigation, there's physical characteristics have been homogenized. This variation across farms in Africa means that different farmers need different types of inputs. They need to use them in different ways, which makes it more difficult to develop new technologies and to develop policies that increase productivity, just because of the diversity of circumstances that farmers have. And I would argue that that diversity extends down to the plot level and is part of the story behind why we see such variation in farmer behavior, even across plots on their own farm.
Well, I want to respond to the heterogeneity issue. I think that's a very interesting issue. And I think that Chris is absolutely right, that a lot of it may be due to that just plain old soil quality heterogeneity that might be greater in African countries than, say, the United States is maybe our benchmark, maybe not. But we don't want to mistake symptoms for causes. That some of that heterogeneity is precisely due to the fact that there's no labor market, and so that the productivity of labor across different sizes of land is very different because there's no equalization of marginal products. So that some of that heterogeneity is in fact a symptom of the fundamental problem that there's small scale and there's no labor market, or labor market transaction costs are such that the labor market can't be utilized very well. So we actually need a little more work, I think, to look at this issue of heterogeneity. I think that would be an interesting research subject to sort out how much of this is a fundamental barrier of soil quality and how much of it is just a symptom of the fundamental problem of the labor markets and the small scale. For example, Chris mentioned leveling. Well, you can't level vast areas of land if each part of that land is owned by a separate person, right? That would require tremendous coordination to level out that land.
It's probably not farmers, not technologies. It's probably the affordability and information dilemma. My experience, there is no such bad soil as the substrate. It's how much you work on that soil, how much nutrients you provide to that soil. It's what type of commodities that you are growing out of that soil. And also how much these farmers are supported to have the right information and technologies that are helping them to make the right decision. I wanted to mention that it's not about the farmers that they are not having adopting any technology, but how do we support them to have a bundle of what is they needed to be productive? I like what Mark is saying, but I don't think that is the land size is a problem. Supporting these farmers to get a good output out of their land, supporting them to have income. Once they get income, they use it for other basic needs, one of them being educating their children. So we don't expect that the next generation is going to be coming back to farm, I assume, other societies that as well, they went through the same trajectory. So the first family that is on the land, it's getting income out of the land. It's educating their children. They go out to be the teachers and other things. So the societies can be able to evolve. But for now, we cannot then go out and say these small scale farmers are not productive because we need to support them. And again, the policy, the support that comes in it to make sure that they get out of this trap is probably what we should be looking at more.
Geraldine, you've made a strong case for why smallholder farming still matters. But do you see small farms as part of the future for agriculture in Africa? And what will it take to make that model work for farmers?
For now, I strongly believe that the small-scale farmers, what they do is still providing livelihoods to millions of people. So that's a fact that we see that is happening. And what we need is to support them to invest, is to support them to aggregate, is to plug them into the value chain so that they can make economies out of what they are doing. What is happening now? These small farmers, they are providing almost 35% of the food that is consumed globally, which means for now, it's really difficult to say that we get out of them. That comes back to looking at what are these small farmers giving out to the nature and the societies. And again, they are going to be productive if we support them to be productive. Mark mentioned something about pushing farmers to aggregate lands. I don't assume that it's feasible today. So the only option that we have is how do we invest in these small farms, make them productive, make the food system work around them, because I assume that jobs that are going to come out of that probably are the ones that are going to be pulling the young people out of that and making sure that we can make progress.
Geraldine, in your earlier comments, you mentioned that you don't expect the children of current generation farmers to want to necessarily be farmers themselves. I agree. I think that in most of the contexts where I've worked, people have different dreams for their children and their children have different dreams for their lives. This seems to sync well with the idea of a transformation of the rural economy in which many fewer people in the long run will be farmers. Farms will be larger. They'll be more mechanized. The returns to labor on farms will be higher than they are now. I hope that this is a consequence of people moving off of farms because they're moving into better jobs in other parts of the economy. And at the same time, a transformation goes on in the agricultural sector in which we see fewer larger farms that are producing more. I think that should be an important goal of policymakers. What we don't want is people being forced off the land in some sense and pushed off into worse situations in a city. But I think that should be the goal of policy, is to try to draw people out of agriculture because they have the opportunities to do something else that is more in line with their goals.
I think it's a fantasy to think that we're ever going to have the kind of land reform that they carried out in France, where people are bought out by the government and in some sense forced to leave agriculture. It's not necessary. But let's be very clear. A program that constantly is providing resources to small farmers is essentially subsidizing small farming. It's encouraging small farming. It's basically cementing the world to be small agriculture. It's a problem that we have literally billions of dollars of money that goes to encourage, through subsidization, small farming. Okay, it's a policy problem. So what are the alternatives? One alternative that Chris mentioned, and also Geraldine, it's just that if the non-agricultural sector becomes attractive, people will leave. It's a fantasy to think that the small farmers in a country in which there's not industrialization, the farmers are going to envision for their children that they should be educated for some world which doesn't exist. So what's very important for the productivity of agriculture, the production of food in the world, is that there be industrialization in these countries. So one solution to this problem of small scale is to focus on industrialization. What I see as the fundamental solution to the problem of agriculture. But it's not the only one. There is an intermediate one, which I had initially thought was also a fantasy, but in fact has been carried out. And that's collective farming, where you don't change any of the property rights of farms. You don't change even necessarily the number of people who consider themselves farming. What goes on is that firms come in and contract with a whole set of farmers owning adjacent land to essentially take over the management of farms. They create a large entity of farming, which can take advantage of mechanization, which eliminates the problem of the absence of labor markets. In China, the government basically subsidized firms to start this up. And then all the farmers saw how this was great. So what we move from is farmers who were sharecroppers to eventually shareholders. They have ownership in this entity, which is a cooperation between business and agriculture, which enormously increases output and incomes for all of these small farmers by taking advantage of scale, but without changing property rights at all, and without any notion that people have to leave agriculture or not. Now, a lot of them are going to be idle. They're going to be shareholders. They don't need all that labor that's there, so they're naturally going to look for certain alternatives.
Here, I'll disagree some with Mark. I agree that moving towards large-scale farming and mechanization is precisely what we need in the long run. And so I'll come back to that. In the short run, I think that there's many inefficiencies in agriculture in Africa that can be alleviated short of this agglomeration. I think that there's opportunities for technological change and market improvement and infrastructure development that will make people better off in the medium run as we go through this process of transformation. It's clearly true that putting resources into small-scale farming will slow down the departure of people from small-scale farming. That's no question. But I think that the benefits of alleviating poverty in the medium term make that a cost worth taking. At the same time, we have to make sure that we don't take steps that lock in an inefficient distribution of land holdings. This is something that I've only come to realize recently, that the interaction between the land tenure system that we discussed before and this process of generating larger scale farm operations is really important and something we have to think about. Mark is right that even with a very clear land tenure system like they have in India, we don't see the growth of larger scale farm sizes precisely because there's a big push that has to take place, a coordination problem. And so the efforts of the World Bank and others to transform land tenure systems in Africa by privatizing and increasing the rights of individuals over their land, increasing the security of land tenure, is, I think, misguided. And I think it's misguided in two different ways. One is that the flexible, complex land tenure systems that exist in at least West Africa play a really important role in social protection in these economies. They provide a way for individuals subject to adverse events to maintain a productive living. The flexibility of that land tenure system enables people to survive adverse shocks, which are very common, and has prevented the emergence of a landless class that we certainly want to avoid. But at the same time, these land tenure systems are political and they're locally based. And so the problem of making the community decision to aggregate land and to farm it collectively, cooperatively, might actually be easier in Africa than in other places because of these collective land tenure systems. There's thinking to be done, research to be done, in trying to understand how that kind of transition might take place in a very different way in Africa than it has taken place in other areas. I have not seen much work on that. It strikes me as a really interesting opportunity to think about.
So as we wrap up, I want to bring us back to the idea of inclusive rural development. We've talked a lot about the need for scale, but of course, many smallholder farmers are still struggling to make ends meet. In that context, what is one shift, whether it's in policy or investment or research, that you think is most important to help us move forward?
I want to make it clear. It's not like I'm against helping out farmers, and there is a current issue of poverty, and people have problems. associated with lack of formal insurance and other things. And so it's very important to understand what's going on and looking for interventions that can help them. But we don't want to lose sight of the big picture. The syllogism that most of the poor people in the world are small farmers, and therefore we need to provide resources for small farmers, is just wrong. If you're interested in reducing poverty, you've got to see a world in which you're transforming the whole economy, such as one where people are moving out of agriculture into productive jobs out of agriculture. Chris mentioned it as an interesting research agenda. Yes, precisely. We need more researchers in understanding what are the barriers, say, to collective farming, because it seems like that is something that could happen and may be more consistent with the current cultural and informal features of African agriculture. We have some China models where we have some government intervention to help it along. So focusing our attention to the bigger picture of how we're going to move people out of agriculture, instead of just fixing the idea that small farmers need help. That's true. But the other side of it is that we need less of them.
Yeah, I think we're on fundamentally the same page. I think that the things that are important areas that we don't know enough about are how to develop new technologies that are appropriate in very heterogeneous contexts that farmers operate in Africa, and how to encourage this transformation of the agricultural sector into a productive source of labor for the rest of the economy without depending upon people being pushed out of agriculture, making it so that people can flexibly be moved out of agriculture into the growing non-agricultural economy.
There is no single country that implement only one policy. So in a country, there are multiple policies that are being implemented simultaneously to get the people out of the poverty. That's number one, which means we need the right policies and strategies that are pro people and that are looking at pulling people out of poverty. The second is we need investments. Once you have investment, you can be able to afford the right technologies. You can be able to invest into irrigation, smart agricultural practices. So for now, what we see is that despite a political will, we don't see that investments coming to be realized. So those two, the right policies and the right investments, I think we still need them. And one of the key words that you mentioned, Catherine, is inclusive rural development. I think with the climate change, with inequalities that we see around, there are people that are going to be left behind. The people that are being left behind today are these rural, small-scale farmers. Again, coming back to the reason of significant investment that needs to be done for them to get out of this poverty. So I think the keyword that you mentioned, inclusive rural development, is the keyword that we shouldn't be leaving on the side.
Geraldine, Chris, Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Development Dialogues. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit egc.yale.edu, where you can sign up for the EGC newsletter. And if you'd like to learn more about VoxDev, head to voxdev.org, where you can sign up for the VoxDev newsletter to receive a weekly summary of the latest economic research. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider sharing it and leaving a rating and review. And look for the next installment of Development Dialogues wherever you get your podcasts.